Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We have been looking at Shakespeare's final romance, The Tempest, one of the great plays of the world, one of the most influential plays of the world. The very next work that we will be looking at in the podcast, Goethe's Faust, is intensely influenced by it, especially in its second half. Faust falls into two halves, the first half being the tragedy per se of Faust in his earlier life, but the second half of Faust, in which there are allusions thick and fast to the Tempest, especially to the figure of Ariel, takes place over a long course of time, developing a character, evolving a character, Faust himself, much in the manner of the romances, and Goethe was clearly aware of and probably inspired by the parallel with the Tempest. At any rate, we have reached the end of Act One of the Tempest. Prospero, the magician, has his former enemies fall into his hand. Here he is, exiled on a desert island for a dozen years after having been deposed as the Duke of Milan and put in a small boat out to sea, luckily with his magic books and with his, at that time, three-year-old daughter, Miranda. That was 12 years ago, and Miranda is now 15. And it is Miranda with which Prospero's actions begin. He summons his servant Ariel, says, "We have work to do and a short time to do it in. I have disposed all of the enemies who have come sailing by. I have summoned up a tempest and caused a seeming, though illusory, shipwreck, and disposed of the people on board about the island in certain significant groupings. And the first grouping is a grouping of one, Prince Ferdinand, son of Alonso, is by himself, and when we see him at the end of Act One, he is grieving for a father that he assumes drowned. And Ariel sings, invisible but audible, the famous song, the most famous of all Shakespeare's songs, "Full fathom five thy father lies," and goes on to say, "Nothing doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange." On one level, the song is ironic, because Ferdinand's father is not at all dead. But in another way, it is deeply thematic, because the sea change is exactly what this play is about. Not a literal sea change of a drowned body, but on a symbolic level, a change of everyone on the island through the instrumentality of Prospero's magic. And beginning here with Ferdinand, whom Prospero deliberately allows to encounter his daughter, Miranda. Young man meets young woman, and it is mutual love at first sight. They are totally smitten with each other instantaneously. Ferdinand bursts out in line 430, "Oh, you wonder," which is a play on Miranda's name. Her name means wonder. And then adds the weird line, "If you be made or no." You wonder about the upbringing that Ferdinand has had. This is not usually regarded as a tactful thing to inquire in a girl that you just met. And not only that, but the insistence on the importance of Miranda's virginity, oddly, to say the least, runs all the way through the play, and eventually we will have to tackle what that obsession might mean. But at any rate, that's what he asks. I suppose he could be wondering, well, you know, I was brought up in a civilized place. You're on a desert island, and maybe you're not a maid. Maybe they don't have those rules around here. But I'm going to ask, and Miranda replies, "No wonder, sir, but certainly a maid. Yes, I am." She might have added, "If only by default, because there's only two men on this island. One of them is my dad, and the other is a half-fish guy named Caliban, who tried to rape me, but luckily did not succeed." Nonetheless, none of that matters. These two are immediately in love within lines. And then Prospero steps in and begins to play. The audience would probably realize pretty quickly that what he is doing is seeming to play, because there is an aside by him that indicates that this is all an act that he's putting on. But he pretends to play the old Senex, the old man, the old possessive parent out of Roman New Comedy. And says all sorts of hostile things to Ferdinand. "You usurp your name. You're a spy. And I'm going to make a slave out of you." And he uses his magic. Ferdinand tries to defend himself, draws his sword, but it's no good against Prospero's magic. And so he is charmed from moving. And Miranda tries to intervene. She tries to pull her father away and beg him to stop acting like this. He says, "Foolish wench, to the most of men, this is a Caliban, and they to him are angels. You haven't seen any men. This guy is ugly. Most men make him look like Caliban." Miranda replies quite touchingly, "My affections then are most humble. I have no ambition to see a goodlier man. My father, I want this one." Which may remind us of Mariana not wanting a better man in Measure for Measure, but this is not a problem comedy, and there is nothing at all problematic about Ferdinand. He's a good and noble young man, and he will prove it, but he's going to have to prove it because Prospero is determined to put him through ordeals. That is the key plot pattern in the play. Prospero has work to accomplish, and the work is to put every single member that has come off of that ship through an ordeal appropriate to their particular situation and what they need and what they deserve. Ferdinand's ordeal must be an ordeal right out of the courtly love tradition from the Middle Ages. A woman has to be earned. It isn't just, "Hey, baby, you're good looking and you must be available because this is a desert island. What about it?" You have to earn her through undergoing ordeals, even ordeals in which you have to humble yourself. And that is what Ferdinand's ordeal will be. Other people, other ordeals are appropriate. And that brings us to moving to the second act and to the second grouping. And this time it really is a group, the large group, usually referred to as the court party. This consists of Alonso, who is the father of Ferdinand, the two utter and complete villains, Sebastian and Antonio, no redeeming social value, which they prove within about 12 lines, the good courtier Gonzalo, We have met both the villains and Gonzalo briefly in the very first scene of The Tempest, in the storm itself, and two minor characters, Adrian and Francisco. It says in the stage direction to Act 2, Scene 1, and others, but in fact, these are the entire party so far as we see. And they are here in the aftermath of the shipwreck, trying to come to terms with it. And Alonso is not coming to terms with it. He has been plunged into deep, what we would call clinical depression, not by the shipwreck, but by the loss of his son. And he feels that his son has been the price of his guilt because he connived with Sebastian and Antonio to depose Prospero 12 years ago. And he knows that was deeply wrong. And he feels that this is the price being exacted by fate and the gods for it. And he is in despair. It isn't just that he is in desert exile. They are all in that position. But he has a deep grief and woe. And Gonzalo is trying to cheer him up by giving him hope and trying to convince him to change his attitude from the negative to the potentially positive. And that is the opening speech of Gonzalo in Act 2, Scene 1. Beseech you, sir, be merry. You have cause, so have we all, of joy, for our escape is much beyond our loss. Look what we just escaped. It's miraculous. You should be joyful. And to put it mildly, Alonso is not having it, and he's not having it because his real grief is for the loss of his son. And Gonzalo tries to convince him that we have no proof that your son has been drowned. He may very well be alive. Last I saw of him, he was swimming forcefully. But Alonso is seeing the worst. The glass is not only half empty, but to Alonso, it's pretty much all empty. He makes the negative assumption. There is a theme here that runs all the way through this scene about how our perception of life, of our situation, of the whole meaning of what we're involved in depends on our attitude, yes. But our attitude is actively constructive. We have to work to make this seem a little deeper than just self-help, smiley button, positive thinking. Though that is how Gonzalo comes off, at least to Sebastian and Antonio, who have the exact opposite attitude. They think the most negative things possible. And there is a real parallel here. In my Shakespeare class at the moment, I happen to be teaching Othello, an earlier play, but a play with a very similar setup. And in that play, Othello is in between two characters, one of whom sees the good in people and in life, and that is Desdemona, and the other, who is this nihilistic reductionist, Iago. Antonio and Sebastian are very cut down versions because that's what always happens when you move from tragedy to comedy or romance. The villain characters, and indeed all of the characters, move from a near Titanic level down to something much more human, all too human. And these two are, to say the least of it, not up to the utterly demonic level of an Iago, but they have Iago's same attitude of what Jung used to call nothing but the attitude that everything is reduced to, it's nothing but this, nothing but that. It's protested to be the reality principle. People claim they're being realists and tough-minded when they talk like that, but that's all just a pretext. It's an attitude they have chosen to adopt, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. What Gonzalo is trying to convince Alonso of is that the positive attitude look on the possibilities rather than the negatives. That too could become a self-fulfilling prophecy, not by wishful thinking, however. We're going to see that this has to go far beyond the level of, oh, I think I can, have a nice day, and it's all just very nice. It has to go beyond that. There has to be an active change and reaching for change, which is why the ordeals. More on this as we move forward. But here, Shakespeare sets up in a scene that could easily be taken for simple gabble, just babbling. At most, it establishes characterization, but does it move the plot forward? And I always tell students over and over again, whenever there's a scene that seems to be just pointless conversation because it doesn't move the plot forward at all, look at it very carefully, because the chances are that it's not moving horizontally in the manner of the plot, but vertically in the direction of theme. And the verticality of the theme is upwards towards an ideal, downwards towards a reduction and the direction of nihilism and negation. And that's exactly the conversation that goes on. Most of this long scene, The Tempest seems to be fond of long scenes that in fact take up most of an act. Act one was that way, act two is going to be that way as well. This huge scene, most of it is the crossing of rapiers between Gonzalo on the one hand and Antonio and Sebastian on the other, though that metaphor is a little misleading in the case of Gonzalo, who is not a fighting type. He's too positive for that. But it is verbal repartee. Gonzalo continues in his speech, trying to cheer up the inconsolable Alonso, and gets interrupted by sarcasm and attempts to undermine and make him look like a naive fool on the part of Antonio and Sebastian. Even the other characters try to help out Gonzalo. Adrian says, though this island seem to be desert, uninhabitable and almost inaccessible, and goes on to say, yet it must be of subtle, tender, and delicate temperance. In other words, mildness or climate. And they make a joke out of it. Antonio says, oh yeah, temperance was a delicate wench. She was a hot girl. I knew her. Gonzalo takes up the ball and says, here is everything advantageous to life. Antonio replies, true, save means to live. Gonzalo says, how lush and lusty the grass looks, how green. Antonio says, the ground indeed is tawny. Sebastian, being sarcastic, says, with an eye of green in it. Gonzalo sees the grass as green. Antonio sees the ground as tawny, a true desert island. Which is correct? Which should we infer? Is Gonzalo looking through rose-colored, or at least grass-colored, glasses? Or is Antonio trying to give a very negative cast to even the geography around them? Or do they genuinely see that way? Blake has a famous aphorism, as the eye, such the object. We do not, Blake says, all live in the same reality. We live in different realities constructed by our imaginations. And reality is indeed different for different people. And we're getting an example of that here before Blake's time. Antonio continues negating. He misses not much, Sebastian says. No, he doth but mistake the truth, totally. And so forth and so on. And we find ourselves, even grudgingly, we find ourselves a bit pulled by the skepticism. We recognize that their nastiness is excessive and, to put it mildly, not helpful. They're trying to be cheering up a man who is in deep grief for loss of his son and filled with guilt for having helped cause this. And instead, of course, they're making it worse. But they are going further than that. The whole intent is to show Gonzalo as indeed just simply naive. This kind of attitude really doesn't do anybody good. You have to face it, and it's bad. It's all bad, right? After all, what is Gonzalo saying? We are here, cast away on a desert island with very little chance of ever being rescued. And the very next thing he says is, hey, but look at the good side. We got free laundry service. Because the next thing that Gonzalo says is, look, our garments, being as they were drenched in the sea, hold notwithstanding their freshness and glosses, being rather new dyed than stained with salt water. Look how good it is. Free dry cleaning. And he just looks ridiculous. In the mind of the part of us that resembles Sebastian and Antonio, the negating part that is in all of us, which is what Blake in his mythology called the specter in all of us, always thinking the worst. Gonzalo talks about, okay, our garments, and our garments are really nice garments because we were coming from a wedding, and we get a little bit of backstory mixed in with more banter. They have been traveling through, this is the Mediterranean somewhere, nowhere, and they have been traveling from Africa back to Italy. And why were they in Africa? They were at the marriage of the king's fair daughter, Claribel, to the king of Tunis. Alonso has a daughter, as well as his son, Ferdinand. And it was his daughter, Claribel's marriage to the king of Tunis in Africa. And Tunis is in the same area as the great, though no longer existent, city of Carthage, site of the great romance between Dido and Aeneas in Virgil's Aeneid. And yet again, I can't tell you how many times Shakespeare indicates that he was utterly fascinated with Virgil's Aeneid, play after play, including Hamlet, references, crucial references to the story of the Aeneid. And here is another one, because the Aeneid opens with Aeneas and his crew of Trojans fleeing from the fall of Troy, stopping in North Africa at Carthage, where Aeneas has a love affair with the queen of Carthage, Dido, And it's a tragic romance because he has to leave her behind in order to go on to found Rome, as he has been commanded to do by the gods. And Gonzalo is making the connection. Tunis, says Adrian, was never graced before with such a paragon to their queen. And Gonzalo says, not since widow Dido's time. And that's an odd phrase, admittedly. And Antonio catches up upon it. Widow? A pox of that. How came that widow in Widow Dido? And he is on the literal, skeptical level quite right. She was not a widow. She was a lover who was abandoned. And either he's too prissy to admit that, or he doesn't know what he's talking about. What if he had said, widower Aeneas, good Lord, how you take it? And Adrian kind of goes along with them and gently says to Gonzalo, widow, Dido, said you, you make me study of that. She was of Carthage, not of Tunis. To which Gonzalo replies, seeming like somebody's grandfather who is just being out of it, having one of his moments, he replies, this Tunis, sir, was Carthage. Adrian rather helplessly says, Carthage? I assure you, Carthage. Now, at that moment, Gonzalo sounds like, you know, we're having a presidential contest based on which of the two candidates is starting to be afflicted with dementia and which is not. Here, Gonzalo sounds as if he is really out of it, having a moment. However, Tunis and Carthage were in the same area, for the one thing. And, as David Bevington's footnote does indeed point out, by the way, let's read the text carefully, both of them were widows. Carthage had been founded by Dido, fleeing from the death of her husband back in Tyre, and Aeneas fled the burning Troy, having lost his wife, Creusa. They are mourning widower and widow, and that's one reason they fall in love. They are lonely, and they try to console each other for it. As with just about everything Gonzalo says, on a non-literal level, shall we say, or even a literal level, since they were literally widowers, Gonzalo has a point that other people are determined not to see. And Antonio is not impressed. What impossible matter will he make easy next? And Sebastian replies, I think he will carry this island home in his pocket and give it his son for an apple. Antonio replies, and sowing the kernels of it in the sea, bring forth more islands. Well, at that moment, they begin to sound as oracular as Gonzalo, perhaps. And maybe, sometimes out of people's unconscious, come things that they don't even really understand what they're saying. The sudden poetic touch there suggests that there is more being said here than either of these two idiots really understand that they're saying. Carrying the island home in his pocket and sowing the kernels of it bring forth more islands. That's a pregnant, strange image, and we'll return to it when we come to see the meaning of the whole play. At that moment, Gonzalo replies, aye, just that single syllable. And David Bevington's footnote, I think quite observantly, says that Gonzalo may be reasserting his point about Carthage, or he may be responding ironically to Antonio, who in turn answers sarcastically. There is a possibility, in other words, that Gonzalo understands quite well that he's being made fun of and is deliberately then playing along in order to play with their heads that he is not somebody's half-senile old grandpa, but knows perfectly well what's at stake here. We shall see. At any rate, Alonso finally responds to Gonzalo, resisting any consolation. You cram these words into my ears against the stomach of my sense. Would I have never married my daughter there? For thence, coming thence, my son is lost, and in my rage she too, who is so far from Italy removed, I ne'er again shall see her. Everything's bad, and it will never be good again. Francisco insists, oh no, I saw him swimming strongly, as we've said. But Alonso simply replies, no, no, he's gone. Alonso can't know that, but he is absolutely determined that that is true. And this is fodder now for Sebastian and Antonio to turn upon him and negate him and reinforce the guilt that is making him depressed in the first place. Sir, you may thank yourself for this great loss, Sebastian says. You would not bless our Europe with your daughter, but rather loose her to an African. So let's slip in a little racism here. And Sebastian says, you were kneeled to and importuned otherwise by all of us. But no, you have to do this, and now we have lost your son, I fear, forever. Nice guys. Gonzalo says, my lord Sebastian, the truth you speak doth lack some gentleness and time to speak it in. You rub the sore when you should bring the plaster, the bandage. And at that point, the scene, instead of ending, this scene is far from over. It goes on for 5 more pages yet. At that point, it enters a new phase because all of a sudden, Gonzalo is inspired to a long speech about if he were king of this island. And what would I do, he says. Sebastian has no better answer than escape being drunk for want of wine. Which is not even correct. We will find there's plenty of wine for certain characters, one of which is a comic alcoholic. Nonetheless, Gonzalo launches into a speech that makes us wonder yet again, can you really believe in all of this? Or are you just, you know, very amiable character, a good-hearted character, but just so naively out of reality that it is beyond belief? Because this is the speech. In the Commonwealth, I would by contraries execute all things. This is in the Commonwealth, if he ruled this island, in this Commonwealth, for no kind of traffic would I admit, no type of trading. No name of magistrate, letters should not be known, riches, poverty, and use of service, none, contract, succession, boom, bound of land, tilth, vineyard, none, no use of metal, corn, or wine, or oil, no occupation, all men idle, all, and women too, but innocent and pure. No sovereignty, to which Sebastian does get in a zinger, yet he would be king on it. True. Antonio says the latter end of his commonwealth forgets the beginning. Gonzalo finishes by saying, all things in common nature should produce without sweat or endeavor. Treason, felony, sword, pike, knife, gun, or any need of engine would I not have, but nature should bring forth out of its own kind all foison, all abundance to feed my innocent people. Sebastian says, no marrying amongst his subjects. Antonio says, not man, all idle whores and knaves. Gonzalo finishes, I would with such perfection govern, sir, to excel the golden age. And that is exactly what he is talking about. What he has just given is a description, probably out of the opening of Ovid's Metamorphoses, of the first golden age. Can he possibly mean that? That is the point at which we will take up next time. Mm-hmm.